Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
It was December last year when we first actually made the wonderful connection with Vancouver-based Wendy Hawken, and a fun time was had by all, so much that 9 months later we felt it's only right that she comes back with even more exciting things to the fore. Wendy, it's good to see you. How are you?
I'm really good, thanks. Thanks for having me here, Alex, and hi, Kaylee.
There we are, indeed. We also have Kaylee Mansell with us as well. And it's presumably been, as ever, a busy year for the W.L. Hawken work scenario, yes?
Very busy year, yes. Very busy year. I've got a few things on the go right now. I'm juggling a whole lot of balls.
Absolutely. And of course, we've also got a wonderful shift in terms of, as well as the Hollystone Mystery Seas series with a coven of West Coast witches who solve murders using ritual magic and a little help from the gods. Well, what's not to love? You've also got, of course, the Lure River Romances, which is always good for rolling the R's, a small town romantic suspense series set in the American Midwest, in the fictional town of Lure River. The first, of course, that we're actually going to be privileged to hear a short excerpt from in a few moments, tells the story of Jesse and Hawk, I believe.
That's correct. This is an interesting story. I can give you a little bit of background on this. And the reason I actually was interested in coming on right at this time is because I'm still a guidance counselor and everybody's going back to school right now. And so when I first wrote this story, I was at university and I was in my mid-30s going to university for the first time. And it was very life-changing experience for me, as I see you have written on your University of Lincoln. That's your phrase, right? About life-changing education. So when I wrote this book, I started it 30 years ago as the first draft, and I had just left my ex-husband and I was in university taking Indigenous studies. And so this book has a lot of reflections around that time and about things I was going through in my life at that time.
Well, always like to actually hear an excerpt. So sometimes I actually do the reading. Sometimes it falls to the creator themselves to actually do the reading. So before we get into a discussion, would you like to just give us a short excerpt from the tale of Jesse and Hawk, of course, in your latest opus, Lure?
Sure, I can do that. Just to set this up a little bit, it's the romantic part of it, and it's a romance, but there's also a mystery involved in it. But the romantic part starts with a woman who is a wildlife photographer. She's living out in the bush. Both of these characters have gone through a lot of change and guilt and loss in their lives, and they both take into the woods to heal. And I think that's something a lot of people need to do, you know, go off into a cabin in the woods or in Hawk's case, a cave, and try and heal from whatever's happened to you. So in the first part of the story, she's photographing a deer that he is hunting. And so as she just has this whole buck set up in her camera lens, and she's just taking all these pictures and her lens is firing, this arrow comes from behind her, hits the deer and kills it. So it starts with a real big clash between the two of them. And it kind of moves on from there. So the part I was going to read is actually where he is living in the cave and he's just hauled this 150-pound deer back with him through the woods to his camp, and he's butchered it in the old ways and set up all the meat and everything else because he's really living off the land, so to speak. And he's talking a little bit about what it's like in his cave. And so I need to set that up. And he also has adopted the first year he got there. He's been there for 3 years now. And the first year he got there, he adopted a wolf cub. And so he calls her sister because, you know, wolves are family, right? So this is the little piece here. The fire flickered in the darkness, casting shadows on the damp cave walls. Above his head, the story of an ancient deer slaying was painted in stone. And across from it on the far wall was a more recent tale, painted by him, of a hunter killing a black bear, an eternal expression of his battle to the death with Makwa, whose winter residence had been this particular cave. The huge black bear had swaggered into the cave that first November, just before dawn. 800 pounds of predator. Surprised to scent man and wolf in his usual winter den, he'd stood in the doorway, stretched to his full height, clacked his teeth and growled. "Stay back, sister." She'd waited in the corner, eyes wide and ears flat. He turned to the bear. "There are plenty of caves, Makwa." Hawk hoped the bear was bluffing. Most black bears he'd encountered hadn't attacked. He talked to them and they backed away, leaving him unharmed. But here in the cave, he couldn't back away. There was nowhere to go. "Just go back the way you came. Go on now, get." Raising an arm, the bear growled a second time, louder and more aggressively. Then the arm came down and pounded the ground. This was more than a bluff. Unprepared to be the bear's last meal before his winter sleep, Hawk stood to his full height, growled from his core and unsheathed his hunting knife. There was no element of surprise. The only chance he stood to win this fight was to make it past those keen claws. Shrieking, Hawk had hung from below, his knife pointed up. He felt the bear's arms close around him in a fierce hug, smelled the fetid breath, heard the teeth gnash, felt his flesh rip as the bear stroked his arms with steel claws. Then he plunged the knife up into its throat. Air, saliva, and blood bubbled from the wound as he twisted with deft movements, severing tubes and arteries. The bear's guttural bawls faded as it lost consciousness, and when it fell, the earth throbbed her sorrow. Hawk slid down himself, drawing deep lungfuls of oxygen, staring at the bloody black bear, his eyes filled with tears, and he tapped his forehead to touch the bear's. Makwa would physically sustain him through the winter ahead. His fur, fat, and flesh would provide food, fuel, and warmth. But of greater importance was Hawk's victory. He was protected by the spirits of this cave. Having slain Makwa, a creature who symbolized strength and courage, that powerful medicine became his. The bear had become one with the hawk. Hawk had become one with the wild. He would survive. This is what the painting said.
Wow. Very, very impressive. Very visceral. Very impactful. Apologies to any vegans or animal lovers out there. Good grief, the comedian's a bear. It's okay. He's fine. Well, he's not in this particular thing, but wonderful way in which you've obviously channeled from the word to and from your lips to God's ears. Let's bring in Kaylee Mansell. Kaylee, your thoughts so far, or indeed questions for Wendy?
Hello, lovely to meet you, first of all.
Yes.
I thought that sounded spectacular. My first question is, some writers would maybe take a break after publishing like an important work that, as you said, has transcended a lot of time. Yeah, it seems that, would you say so, that it kind of gives you an adrenaline to continue writing and to improve yourself even more so than you have over the years? Would you say that that's your writing process more than, okay, it's published, I can take a break now?
Yeah, I don't take breaks. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, like I said, I have a few things going on right now, and they're all things that have come out of different places and have traveled with me, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote this, I had written most of the first four books in the Hollystone series, and I move around a lot. I'm a bit of a bohemian in that way, and I had moved a couple of years before and found this manuscript still in brown paper from 30 years ago. So I thought, oh, I think I should read this and just see where I was at in those days, because I was a very, you know, different person. I was just, mm-hmm. I had just started my degree in Indigenous Studies at the time. So that is really reflected in this story. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a lot about Indigenous Studies, and that was part of my life-changing experience back then. So I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, it's a romance. And it had a lot of Indigenous teachings and in healing in the book. So I started to rewrite it. I thought, I'll give it a shot. So I got just a little ways through it. And then as my process is, I listen to the characters, mm-hmm. and I hear a lot of conversations, and I see movies and all kinds of things. And this woman appeared who actually was, well, what happened is the main character, Jessie, found a skeletal hand coming up out of her shed, and she realized someone had been murdered and buried mm-hmm. in her shed. And she's on a Chippewa reservation renting a cabin. And so she calls in the tribal police, and it turns out that, you know, this is this young Indigenous girl who's been missing for 20 years. And so that story grew up out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I connected with that young Indigenous girl, and I said, "What happened to you?" Because this is kind of my process. How did you end up here? What happened to you? And so her name is Ruby Little Bear, and Ruby came through and told me her whole story. So I ended up incorporating her story in chunks throughout this story because they're connected, obviously. And also missing and murdered Indigenous women is such a big topic here in our part of the world. And I don't know if it's made it to the UK or not, but certainly here, Indigenous women are really, really preyed upon. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that's come out of the culture, and, you know, it's been allowed to happen many years. So there's a bit of a statement here about Ruby is talking about what happened with her. And so that it changed. So it changed as I wrote it, and then it became much better. And of course, my writing has changed an awful lot since for over 30 years. So mm-hmm. that happened. So I wrote that, but I also have a couple other things going on at the same time.
Yeah, naturally, as is right.
Yeah.
No, that's amazing, though. I think it's good that it's transcended time, but you've improved it and you've worked upon your younger self's vision for it and made it something that you can be proud of now. So I think that's cool. Yeah. And speaking of your process as well, I'm really curious what automatic writing is.
Right. Okay.
I've heard of the term before, so I thought I'd ask a clear answer.
Because
I have no idea what it is. So
for sure, I can absolutely speak to that. I mean, one of the other things that I've got going is I taught a few workshops called about my process called From Spirit to Page: Writing with Your Muse, and mm-hmm. that is one of the things we do. And lately, I've unearthed that book, and I've been trying to get that out. It's kind of a nonfiction about my process, but with automatic writing, it's a little bit like channeled writing in that the rules are basically that you get into a meditative state, which is what I do when I'm going to write anything. Mm-hmm. And you kind of pick up your pen or you have your fingers on the keyboard, and you get rid of everything else in your mind. And then you just write. Now I usually ask a question. So that happens a lot for me. I'll say like, okay, what happens next when I'm writing? And then you just write without editing, without asking yeah. questions, without analyzing. You're just writing really from your mm-hmm. alpha state, what the answer is. And you'll get like several pages. And if you're really doing it properly, you don't read it until you're finished. And you sort of get to a point where you're like, oh, phew, that, okay, I think that was that was it. And then you can read it back. And it's kind of brilliant. It really is.
It how sounds that works. It. Wow. It,
yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
I've used that for plotting a lot, you know, like in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and be like, well, ask the question before I go to sleep, what happens next? And then in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh man. And you don't want to turn the light on, but you know what? You got to do it. So
yeah.
I'll wake, you know, have a scroll of a notebook there and pick up my notebook and just start writing what they're telling me. And so my muses, right? And so I'll write this all down, and then it's a good job you do, because in the morning, what happens is you read it and go, oh wow, okay. And that is my process. So the first scene in this book actually happened like that, and I dreamed it and I woke up with it and just sat down in the computer, and my job is to write what I mm-hmm. see. So it's like if you're watching a movie, for example, on Netflix, and then taking that and going, okay, now I'm going to write what I just saw in that scene, and you write out the scene. That's kind of how I work.
Amazing. It sounds like a great process. I'd heard of it, but I wasn't sure. So thank you for your explanation. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. I don't know where it comes from.
Is it something, Kaylee, you're likely to be trying to apply in your own budding
Why
career
not?
As a writer, doing
of
creative
course.
Writing and so on?
Yeah, I follow something similar, less sophisticated. It's the phrase write drunk, edit sober. So it's called a blurt. So you just blurt everything down in your mind. And then not literally drunk and sober, but then say the next day you read it back and the parts that were valuable to you through that blurt you pick out. And so the essence of what you were writing is there in those few words, but you don't have to have all of the unnecessary outer working. So yeah, I do something similar, but perhaps I will dabble. Perhaps now that I know about it, sure, why not?
Wendy, when last we spoke, we obviously found out about your spirit guide, Louis, your imaginary friend when you were a child. We found out about, obviously, Peter Gabriel and his musical influences from yourself. Is music still an important part of your whole writing process? And I've got to ask the question, was Louis involved in any way, shape or form with Lua?
Oh, no. I mean, Louis's from my childhood, and I'm not sure that Louis is still around. Definitely. I'm sure I have some spirit guides. I think they change throughout your life, and ones come along that that are important. I mean, when I was writing Lure, I definitely had a spirit guide, and because I went to a psychic at one point, and she said, "Who is that man standing behind you with a scar in his chest?" And I said, "Oh, I've been dreaming about him." And so I know that I had that. And actually, sidebar to that, she said, "Well, there's a woman on the other side, and she looked kind of like Emily Dickinson." So I had these kind of two warring spirit guides at that time. Now I'm going back to a time when I was finishing up my high school in my mid 30s. Okay, because I quit school when I was 16. I don't think you know that about me, so. I was an at-risk kid. I was a high school dropout. I ended up in Toronto when I was 17, working as a secretary and getting into all kinds of mischief. And then met my husband pretty soon after that and kind of got taken away into a marriage for 17 years. And then I decided I wanted to finish high school in my mid-30s. I had a lot of spiritual stuff going on. I was meditating for like 2-3 hours a day at that point. And that's why I think I connected to all of these spirit guides, but also began this process. That's when it really started to happen for me. And where was I going? Hang on. I was there. Oh, and so I had taken a Native Studies course through my high school where I was trying to catch up. So I don't know what your grades are like here, but we have 12 grades in Canada, 13 actually in Ontario. And I had to take these courses to graduate. And so I had taken History 12 and English 12. And I took this Native Studies course and it just blew my mind. And so I wanted to take more Native Studies courses. And my husband was against it. So he was not supportive at all. He basically he had a lot of fear that I would get educated and then I would leave. I left and got educated. So that's kind of, it was kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy on his end. But that's what happened. And so I ended up going to university as a single mother in my mid 30s. And I had taken this whole Native Studies course, but I didn't know what to do at the end of this. I had a BA in Indigenous Studies. And I wanted to teach school, but I needed something else. So I had this war going on between English literature and Indigenous studies. And when I came out here, that's what she was seeing when she saw these two warring kind of spirit guides. And I don't know if they're really there or if that's, who knows what these things are, right? Or if it's an aspect of my personality or my consciousness or what it was. But as it turned out, I came out to Simon Fraser University and I applied into the the teaching program, and they said, well, it's great you have a degree in Indigenous studies, but it's not a teachable subject. So you need something else. Now it might be. Then it certainly wasn't.
It's interesting you talk about Indigenous studies, because also 30 odd years ago, which seems to be a interesting number we're working with here, I know that two of our regular co-hosts and co-presenters, Randy Reinholtz and Jean Bruce Scott, were founding the Native Voices Institute at the Autry. And clearly that has been hugely successful over the last few decades in terms of providing, as its name suggests, the opportunity for Native Indigenous cultures of the Americas to effectively get their story across, which for many years clearly was part of the Hollywood cliched rigmarole of stereotypes and issues relating to that. So I'm intrigued in terms of how that also connected and opened up this very wide-ranging and important series of stories that clearly need to be shared from the original occupants, of course, of the North American area.
Absolutely. And that's what's going on here now. I mean, since we got into truth and reconciliation, it's a huge thing now that about, you know, own voice and telling stories. And there are protocols and all kinds of things about who can tell what stories and that sort of ownership of stories and everything. So it's pretty complex, and it's pretty wonderful that it's come to the forefront now in that kind of depth.
Well, looking at some of the comments that have already been made about Lua, USA Today bestselling author Danica Bloom writes, a suspense-filled romantic story about unique and intriguing characters who are also highly relatable. Story will stay with her. Amanda Bidnell, editor, of course, a finely drawn romance with unique characters and a vivid sense of place. Lua doesn't shy away from the grittier aspects of small-town life, but it will sweep you away nonetheless. And that aspect of America is something which, again, may be subject to a number of cliches in terms of the picket fences, the small town, middle American environment. It's not got the pace of Los Angeles or the anxiety of New York or the busyness of Chicago or a big city life. But it is something which, nevertheless, for a significant population, clearly is their reality and their lived reality. Was that something also that you had intended to capture, that sense of the veneer of civilization that can be cracked by really just digging a little bit below the surface, finding out what's going on there?
That's an interesting comment. I'm not sure if I intended to capture anything. I definitely think that when people are in some kind of trauma, that they often will go out into the woods to heal or to connect with nature, to find their way through. And I mean, I do that for sure. And I've always wanted to live in a cabin in the bush. I mean, that is part of, I think that is part of the American thing, right? You know, you've got your Thoreau kind of folks, and you know, that's a big thing about going out and writing in the bush. And so these two both end up living on a Chippewa reservation with no technology. And as a writer, I really appreciate having to write about people in a place where they don't have to deal with
emails. How could they cope without mobile phones to do that? TikToks, for goodness sakes.
I know, exactly. And it's so annoying having to add that to your stories these days if you're writing contemporary. And so, I mean, one of the things is that her friend is quite worried about her because she doesn't have a cell phone. She doesn't have any service. And she's out there living in the bush with just her horse. And, you know, he's in a cave with a wolf. And, you
Sounds
know.
Sounds like an ideal partnership, Wendy, surely.
Yeah, you know? I know, right?
He's got his cave. He's got his wolf. She's got the horse. Ideal, yeah, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is nice to be able to do that. And yeah, there are a lot of people that do live off grid. I mean, certainly where I am now in BC, there's a lot of people that, well, they have email, but they're living off grid. Mm-hmm.
And some might say it is a route forward. I know that there's another issue when it comes to houselessness as opposed to homelessness, people who've specifically chosen to live without the hassle of contemporary society as they perceive it. And in many ways, it's an interesting life choice that requires a certain amount of bravery to go into in the first place, I would have thought.
Absolutely. Like, there's so many ways you can live a life. You know, the whole living in like a little suburban house is
just one.
Just one, you know? Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Kaylee, let's turn back to your good self. Any further questions you'd like to put to Wendy?
Yeah, maybe a boring question, but what kind of novels did you read before becoming a writer? I suppose there's no before becoming a writer, but you understand, like, growing up, maybe were you inspired by those genres to kind of put into what you write now? I feel like that's usually the narrative that happens. You read fantasy, you write fantasy, but would you agree with that on your personal writing process?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a voracious reader, and I move around a lot. I'm an INFP, which basically means personality wise. I don't know if you guys know Myers-Briggs or not, but I'm like an intuitive, feeling, perceptive kind of person. So I'm not a thinker so much as a feeler. And so I do remember from my childhood a couple of interesting things. One, my favorite book, which actually still I have it now, I went and found it in a rare bookstore, was The Curious Adventures of Fairy Fluster. And yeah, I think it might actually be from the UK.
Oh, wow.
And it was about this little fairy that, you know, when it went around and got into trouble all the time. And another book that I remember, I grew up in rural Ontario, and we had, the library was like a closet, you know, in the elementary closet. And I got this book called The Golden Pine Cone, which I just devoured. And the interesting thing, I was about 9 then. I now have that too. I went and found it because I needed to reread it. And it again is about fairies, but it's also about fairies who meet an Indigenous person, and it's set in BC. And so here I am, you know, I'm not going to say how many years later. I can't do the math. But here I am writing Indigenous books and fairy books in BC, you know, so many years later. So I think, yes, I think those things do color our perceptions. You know, I think that most of my serious reading wouldn't have got started till I got into university in my mid-30s and, you know, took English literature and then kind of read all the classics. And I'm a big fan of the classics. So that's interesting. And also reading a lot of Indigenous authors. So that colored things in a different way for me. But yeah, I'm a big mystery fan though. So yeah.
Do you think as a writer you belong to one genre, or would you like to keep it open? Do you want to be bound to one genre? Because I personally don't think you should ever.
No.
Yeah.
No. I'm actually a genre bender blender. I mean, I really, my Hollystone books are very much, they're about a coven of witches who solve murders using ritual magic. So they're based right from that. You can see already we've got mystery, thriller. There are fairies in there. There's vampires in there. So they're kind of urban fantasy, but they're also mystery and thriller. So that's going on there. And this one too, even though it's based on a romance, there's a mystery in there of what happened to the Indigenous girl. So I couldn't do that. I mean, I know there are people that say, I'm just going to write cozy mysteries about this town. And that's great if you can do it, because it's a really great way to stay focused. But I'm not very good at focusing in that way. I kind of wait for the little tap on my shoulder. Hey, hey, you need to write a book about me. Let me tell you my story. And then I'm like, okay, fine. And, you know, that's how my Hollystone book started, for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm actually starting book 5 there right now as well.
Lovely. Amazing.
Lua was obviously released in February this year and is doing extremely well from that perspective. Any plans for the next stage of the adventures of Jesse, the vegan nature photographer, and of course, Hawk, the wounded doctor bent on losing himself on the Chippewa reservation? I mean, will Hawk find himself? Are there plans afoot? Have you scheduled the next adventures?
Well, I mean, you have to read the book to know how that, if Hawk finds himself, because, you know, that's where that goes. I did say it's Little River Romances. So I do have, a sort of a thought of, for one of the characters, not either of them, but for one of the other characters to have a romance. But this is more based on the town. So it's kind of a great way of being able to flip between different characters in the town and focus on them. Yeah.
It's the Hawkinsverse, clearly. The Hawkinsverse, different characters coming together and generating a whole...
A lot going on here.
Zone. And as somebody who's clearly been an inspiration to folk who might have thought that they could never write the book, they could never go to university, those are all challenges that are actually there. What advice would you actually have to maybe somebody who might be listening to this and think, do you know, I think I should actually take that step. Is it a case of keep the faith and take that leap of faith? What would you say?
You know what? I really think education is where it's at. And I mean, for me, it was so freeing. It allowed me to do so many things that I never would have been able to do. So I think it's really important. Yeah. And even if just starting with one course is a good way in, like if you don't think you can do it, or if you're like someone like me who has quit school when I'm very young, then going back, and it's a little bit scary, but it's also amazingly freeing and inspiring to do it. So take the first course. The thing is, you know, that saying way leads on to way. That's what happens with education. And so really for me, when I started out and I was just doing the Indigenous studies, doing the literature, and I had taken a couple of courses in special ed, and then I had is there something else I had done there? Anyway, I decided. And I had taken my teaching, right, my professional development, and then I was looking for my first contract job. So the way that it works is that when they needed somebody, I had applied to this school district, and when they needed somebody, they picked me for a contract because I had some special education schooling, and they needed somebody to work in a resource room. And so from there, I got my first contract in the school district, which has really served me well. And then also from there, I was able to go in and teach. I taught English literature for many years because I had those courses from English literature that I had to take. And then along came an opportunity to be an Aboriginal education coordinator for the district. So I applied for that, and I got that too, because I had the Indigenous education. So things really work. And now I'm still actually in education. So now I'm a guidance counselor for an online school, as well as writing. So my work as an educator finances my work as a writer. So you see that, like, those pathways are so very, very twisted, you know, and you never know who you're going to meet. So, I mean, one more little sidebar is that when I was doing my first courses in English way back at Simon Fraser University, I met a woman there, and we were both older, and we were both, you know, pursuing some courses. And she ended up becoming a lighthouse keeper out here on the BC coast. And I thought, okay. And so I watched her do that. And then when I was teaching near the end of my English teaching career, and I was so stressed out teaching high school, because really, if you're an introvert, this is not the way to go. Okay. I'll tell you that. Good thing to know. I decided I'm going to take a year off and be a lighthouse keeper. And I did that. And because I knew that she had done it, and I knew how to approach it and how to get an application to the Coast Guard, because I actually joined the Coast Guard to do this. And I ended up being a lighthouse keeper for a year. And out of that, I've just written another novel, which is completed, called Ghostlight, which is about a girl who becomes a lighthouse keeper. She's also a medium. So there's a whole book in there. So there, again, way leads on to way. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to take that first step, and with an open mind, and really kind of sink into it and see where it leads you, and not kind of put up barriers as to, oh, I don't want to do that, or, you know, that's too much work, or I'll never be able to do that. That's all that negative self-talk, which just doesn't help us at all. You know, I mean, everybody can do this.
Wendy, it's been fantastic connecting with your good self. I can't believe it was the 3rd of December 2021 when you made your debut as far as the Midweek Drive was actually concerned. That was, of course, was with Robert Weston, of course, who indeed has been one of Kayleigh's tutors at the University of Lincoln, I believe, in terms of creative writing. We also, of course, had Jessica Burtis there. Jessica and Robert both send their best. Jessica currently doing her master's in children's literature at the University of Dublin. Effectively. So it's all connecting together. But it's brought us neatly round to almost the last couple of questions. Apart from actually saying, Wendy, how can people actually follow you on the various social media? Are you an Instagram gal? Are you more TikTok? Are you what's the sort of official way to get in touch with you?
I do have an Instagram account, actually. But the best place to find me is bluehavenpress.com. And that's my publishing company and my website. And from there, you can find all the other ways to get to me. But yeah, I'm not a TikToker. I tried it, and I just found, I don't know, I felt old and desperate. What can I say? That's my honesty coming through there. I was like, what? I mean, I do videos and everything, but it was too much for me. So.
I think I can understand. I understand exactly where you're coming from. So the last two questions, Wendy, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this, your return to the Midweek Drive? Has it been good for you?
Oh, absolutely. I love joining you guys and chatting. It's a very pleasant experience.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you be back on the program before too long and share more Hawkins magic?
I would love to. It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. One day I might show up at your doorstep there at the University of Lincoln.
That's the way forward. Or we'll come over to Vancouver. One of the two things. Wendy Hawken, for the moment, huge thanks. Thanks to Kayleigh Mansell as well. Keep on keeping on. And remember, of course, Lua available on all good platforms. Do you prefer whether your readers actually have a physical copy or read it electronically, Wendy? It's just an interesting line. Some authors say, no, you've got to have a physical copy.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, ebooks are a great way to read, and an easy way to read, you know. Physical copies are good too, but I mostly sell physical copies in my area when I'm doing like book markets and things like that. So, well, yeah.
There we are. Wendy Hawken, we salute you. Take care now.
Thanks.
Bad diets, missing breakfast, sugar is the new nicotine. All of these messages come across to us when we're actually looking at a good, healthy lifestyle. But what are the myths and what are the actual things we need to be aware of? We've certainly said that over the years, if you have a top line automobile and you put sugared water into it, you can't expect it to run well. The best person surely to go to actually address some of these nutritional myths that have been identified via a recent survey from Herbalife Nutrition is, of course, the awesomely talented nutritionist extraordinaire from Herbalife Nutrition and indeed head of nutrition at both Tottenham Hotspur's women's team and a former head of performance nutrition at Arsenal Football Club. Well, I don't think he can hold both at the same time. Well, that would be quite interesting. It's Richard Allison. Dr. Richard Allison, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Well, great to connect with your good self. And let's talk us through some of the findings from this particular survey, because it does seem as though we get very confused when something as basic as nutrition is talked about, because when people say it's more challenging to comprehend than reading a map, you realize you've got one or two challenges that are actually out there.
Yeah, so the research conducted by Herbalife Nutrition showed that up to 66% of people in the UK believe some form of nutritional myth and therefore find it misleading. And obviously in our modern age of social media, and there's a lot of information that we can get quite readily, and a lot of that information can be misleading. So it's completely understandable that people are confused about something as simple as about what they should eat on a daily basis.
I mean, let's talk through some of the kind of findings that are actually out there. I mean, you've obviously specialised in this. You're concerned very much working with athletes and top-range physical competitors about what to actually eat. Things like missing breakfast, for instance. People say that's the most important meal of the day. Is that true? Is it a case of, no, I'll just cope with a couple of coffees at breakfast and then move straight into having a mega lunch?
Yeah, so of course it depends. What are you looking at? Typically is your overall intake across the course of the day. And that is the main thing. And whether, you know, that's looking at calories in versus calories out, if you're trying to obviously lose weight, it's the total amount of calories that you take across the day that's the most important thing. Now, for some people, missing breakfast might be beneficial in terms of that it fits their lifestyle. For example, if you're a person that exercises first thing in the morning, you might not be able to eat breakfast prior to, say, going for your run or going to the gym. And therefore, your breakfast might be pushed later to the day and even as far back as lunchtime. However, there are obviously differences for, say, children going to school. It's often recommended, or we would often recommend, that children or people, say, who are studying need the carbohydrate in the morning to aid the studying, to give them concentration, because you don't want to be flagging during the class, you might miss something. So it really depends on the person as an individual, but the overall intake is the most or the key priority.
So really a kind of bespoke format for everybody is probably merited. Let's talk nutritional supplements. I mean, I'm a great believer in things like selenium, zinc, that actually we're very low in our selenium quantities in Britain in particular. There are lots of sort of issues with respect to that. And every so often you get a major news story which says, oh, nutritional supplements, they're not worth it. You don't go in terms of them, etc. Let's focus a little bit on that, because obviously that's something which Herbalife Nutrition is particularly keen to address.
Yeah, so for a lot of people, now don't get me wrong, it would be fantastic if everyone across, say, the country, across the globe, could get nutritious meals, balanced nutritional meals across, you know, the whole day that met their nutritional needs and was, for example, you know, had adequate selenium in their diet across the day. Unfortunately, in the modern world, that isn't the case. And it's very important to have what we call nutritional insurance. And this is where things such as supplements, shakes, can play a part of a healthy, balanced diet. So they can support and supplement the real food that you're eating to make sure that you are getting the right amount of micronutrients and macronutrients, so carbs, proteins, fat, for your individual needs.
So really looking at this sense, as you said, getting the balance right, making sure that you are taking in fewer calories than you're actually using, obviously good exercise. The key thing that I seem to be getting, Richard, from this is balance is crucial.
Yes, and balance is obviously individualized. So, for example, if you're a person who sits at a desk for 8 hours a day, your nutritional needs are going to be different to, say, the laborer working at the building site or the professional athlete that's training for 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 hours a day. So it's about that balance, but it's individualized balance.
Just wearing your hat as head of nutrition at Spurs women's team, from that perspective, did you find that your sports folk actually take it on board avidly? I mean, when you were at Arsenal, was it a case of people sort of took this, you know, very much with a pinch of salt, or had the legacy of Arsene Wenger effectively sort of rooted in nutrition as being vital, and that the days of actually having several pints before and after a match for footballers, they've kind of gone?
So you're absolutely right with your last point. Those days are very much behind the professional sports person. So both in the men's game and the women's game, the level of professionalism is so much higher, and it has to be. You know, the modern game is different, and therefore nutrition plays a role in that. And therefore the players' attention to nutrition, their understanding of nutrition, and their understanding of the importance of nutrition is elevated. And it's not just about short-term performance on the pitch. They're also very much aware of long-term health, but also these longer careers. So, for example, you know, we're seeing Cristiano Ronaldo playing at 37 years old. There are not many players in either the men's or the women's game that are playing late into their 30s. And obviously, nutrition plays a role in that.
Yeah, I suppose Jamie Milner would be somebody also who would fulfill that, yeah, as far as Liverpool is actually concerned. But let's not go down that line. I mean, I've got to ask the question, when you switched from Arsenal to Spurs, was it a case of, oh, no, it's like the medical version of Sol Campbell? How can you do this?
No, it's just about being professional. And I look at whenever I work with teams, I look at the players as individual people that they are, you know, and That's the way it has to be.
Quite rightly so too. Now let's go back to Herbalife. What's the best place to go to find out further details about what we've been discussing today? Because presumably, even if you're not a professional athlete, you want to ensure that your quality of life is maintained and that hopefully you'll be able to enjoy sport, even as a spectator, in a more healthy manner.
Yeah, so the simplest thing is to put Herbalife Nutrition into your search engine, and the first website that will come up will be the one that you need to go to. And there's information on there in terms of both the nutrition side, but there's also links to, you know, what advice on movement and physical activity as well.
Dr. Richard Allison, nutritionist for Herbalife Nutrition and indeed head of nutrition at Tottenham Hotspur women's team, huge thanks and stay healthy.
Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott
and Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
So back in the 20th century, we had the Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition. We also had, of course, Martin Luther King's Dream and so on. And actually, the whole essence of Star Trek is built on diversity and working through that whole process. But what about actually ensuring that we do have full representation of the diverse society in which we exist today, and so on and so forth? Well, to actually talk about this and more, we've got the fabulous Natalie Ambersley, trustee at the Vita LIGO Society, and indeed ACE individual. Natalie, welcome to the program. How are you keeping?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Now, you're an ambassador for the condition of albinism. Would you like to just share with us from that point of view how that has impacted your life and your own personal experiences with respect to this?
Yeah, sure. So I'm an ambassador for the skin condition vitiligo, which is a skin condition where white patches form on the skin due to a lack of melanin. It can affect anyone of any age, but most people develop the condition by the time they're 40 years old. So I developed the condition when I was 3, so an age where I couldn't even understand the condition, let alone pronounce the word vitiligo. And, you know, life was quite tough. As a child, I, you know, played with children. Children accepted me. I had a real innocent view of what beauty was. It was only when I got to my teenage years that things started to really change and I started to really struggle with having a skin condition because it made me stand out. As I mentioned before, it's highly visible and I didn't know anyone with the condition. So it was really difficult for me to fit in with anyone else. So I went through a number of different cycles in my life. I lacked confidence. I lacked self-esteem. I was constantly judging myself. And, you know, I felt very, very unattractive because there was this ideal view of what you should look like in society. And I simply didn't fit in with that.
And certainly that sense of representation is fairly critical, I would have thought, in terms of how children will see themselves in the toys that they actually play with. So this presumably is one of the reasons why this new Series 4 range that's being produced by Rainbow High is fairly critical for ways in which people can actually cope with vitiligo.
Absolutely. It is incredibly critical. When I was growing up, there were no toys that represented me. So I felt very isolated, very uncared for, and I felt very, very much unimportant. Whereas now things are changing and they're changing for the better. So toys like the Rainbow High, where there is a doll that has vitiligo, is an incredible breakthrough. When I think about some of the stats around some recent research that was conducted by Rainbow High, it was found that 79% of parents say diversity is important when it comes to purchasing toys, because we want our children to feel included, we want them to feel supported, and we want to teach them that everybody in society can be beautiful regardless of what you have.
And those key things that you actually just mentioned there inevitably feed into the developmental way in which children actually develop, because as we've said frequently, children aren't born racist. They're actually taught that by society. They're born to actually deal with difference from that point of view. And if they can be encouraged from a young age to see that differences don't matter, or indeed take a delight in the differences, perhaps even more importantly, then hopefully it'll help the human race become a better overall species, I would have thought.
Absolutely. It will make an incredible difference. And, you know, toys like this are about raising awareness and educating people and making sure that people understand that there are different people in society. You know, it's a huge breakthrough. And even as an adult, you know, it's something that, you know, I just absolutely love seeing. When I think about the vitiligo community itself, when I look at, you know, different posts on social media of parents showing these toys exist, I can see how happy they are. They feel supported. They feel like their children are included, and kids don't feel so isolated. So, you know, it's something that we need to build on. We need to see further growth in these areas, and we need to show all communities that it's important that they are represented too.
There's, of course, the Rainbow High hashtag, hashtag Let Your True Colour Shine. Where can people actually go to find out further information about what we've been talking about today and the Rainbow High range of dolls, Natalie?
So the dolls are available in most UK high street retailers. You can also find them on Instagram under rainbowhigh.uk. And if anyone does have vitiligo out there and needs support or needs someone to talk to or just has any questions, they can head over to the Vitiligo Society at vitiligosociety.org.uk.
And you're also the editor for VitLife, the Society's members magazine, and indeed assist with social media as well. So clearly you're doing your bit. Natalie Ambersley, trustee at the Vitiligo Society, huge thanks. And keep on keeping on.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
Perceptions of jobs are something which clearly tie into the whole notion of stereotypes and issues relating to that in all sorts of ways. And it seems as though when it comes to different perceptions, social workers have still got a challenge in terms of overcoming the perceptions that people actually have in terms of what they do, how they go about them, etc. Over half of people believe social workers have a bad reputation, which leads to almost a third of folk not wanting to engage with them in any way, shape or form. Negative perceptions being particularly prevalent amongst minority communities and so on. So let's talk a bit about this by addressing the issue with the head of diversity of inclusion at Frontline, the official training body charity who actually trains social workers across the nation. That's Lisa Zarenika. Sorry, Lisa. I'm not sure whether I got the pronunciation of Zarenika quite right there, but how are you? Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Alex. Yes, and you did get the pronunciation right.
Okay, thank you for that. This negative perception, it's a big challenge, isn't it? Particularly given that arguably the country needs its social workers more than ever before.
Absolutely, Alex, and you're right. It's a huge challenge. We have one in four children and families living in poverty currently. That is set to increase as the cost of living crisis takes hold. And it's really important that social workers are able to reach those families to offer the invaluable support to avert kind of crisis, to avert harm to children and families, and to support them to get through it.
Is it due to a lack of understanding that actually people don't understand what social workers actually do? They read some of the negative impacts that have come across from media stories where social workers have perhaps got it wrong for reasons that, you know, are understandable in other sort of ways, that people actually have this negative media perception of what a social worker is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the view that we have of social work comes through that really narrow lens of when we hear of the tragic and often really harrowing child death. And rightly so, there should be kind of a focus on social work at that time, and people should be held to account, not just the social work profession, but the systems and structures around that too. I think the challenge is that that's often the only image and portrayal of social workers. So we don't get to hear the brilliant work that happens every day with the kind of 700,000 children and families that social workers work to support, to empower and to get through some really challenging times in their lives. And I think it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the stigma around social work involvement means that it's not necessarily something that families or individuals will talk about themselves. So they don't shout to everybody that they had a social worker, because that then will lead people to maybe question why they needed social work intervention. So we really do need to get out a different narrative, a different picture of social work, to really celebrate the great work that social workers do and the success and the positive outcomes that can come for children and families as a result of their intervention.
staggering to find that amongst minority communities in the UK, many would actually say they would simply never deal with a social worker, even if their family needed support. What's the best way of, again, addressing this issue? I mean, we're obviously we're talking about it here, we're raising that sort of topic. Is there a place that people actually go to say, find out exactly this is what social workers actually do, this is how they are trained, this is how they are professionals, in the same way as your local pharmacist might be a suitable contact for healthcare, and your local GP and other folk, these are professionals in their field?
Yeah, I think that, as you said, part of it is engaging with media such as yourself. Frontline is launching an early engagement campaign, which is very much about getting a different narrative of social work out there. I think that we seek to train people who perhaps wouldn't think about coming into social work ordinarily. And I think that I think about my own experience of coming into social work, having previously studied law, and that was something, myself as a woman of colour, my family were not particularly supportive of, because of some of those negative stereotypes of what the social work profession is. So I think that the more that we can support people who maybe wouldn't think about coming into the profession to join, the more we can celebrate what they achieve and the success that they have in the same way that we do other professions, I think the more that people will become interested, be curious, and find out more about it. And I think that's imperative, because, as you say, many of the communities that we need to access and serve much more effectively are put off from coming into the profession because they perhaps put off from accessing social work intervention because they perhaps see it in the same way as other institutions that maybe have let them down. So I think we need to be making sure that we are providing social workers who can change that narrative as a result of being part of the profession.
Indeed. Now, where can people go to find more details about Frontline and indeed pursue a little bit more information about what we've been discussing today, Lisa?
Well, we've got our early engagement campaign launching next week, and I would encourage people to have a look at us on our website. You can look at the Frontline website, which gives a lot more information about how you can join the Frontline programme if you're interested, and a lot more about kind of what we do.
Lisa Zaranica, Head of Diversity and Inclusion at Frontline, the official training body, a charity who trains social workers across the nation. Huge thanks, and keep up the excellent work. Take care now.
Thank you, Alex.